You're listening to Sipping on Some Crime podcast, hosted by Aaron. This podcast covers sensitive and triggering subjects, explicit language, and mature content which may not be suitable for children. As always, all parties are innocent until proven guilty.
Hi guys, it's Erin and welcome back to the 50 State Cold Case Spotlight. Today we are in North Dakota. Today is day one and I will be spotlighting the case of Larry Joe Phoebus. Larry 14 was living in the Tioga Hotel with his brother Chester, 19 years old, and they had a roommate named Sam who worked with Chester in the oil fields. Chester and Larry's father was back in Indiana serving prison time, so it seems that Chester took Larry to North Dakota while he worked in the oil fields while his mother stayed home in Indiana to care for his younger siblings. While in North Dakota, Larry was enrolled in a local school and had been attending for about 6 weeks before he went missing. On October 20th, 1962, Sam and Chester decided to head out on a double date, leaving Larry to stay at the hotel at night. When Sam and Chester returned home from their date that night, Larry was nowhere to be found. Chester did attempt to look for his brother by talking to those in the hotel, talking to his classmates, and also those in the community while he searched for Larry. It is reported that it took Chester some time to go to police to report his brother missing. However, it is not noted how long that took. In December, Chester would leave North Dakota and head back to Indiana to visit his mom for the holidays and let her know that he was not able to find Larry. They said it was a very sad holiday. Sometime after the holiday, Chester and his mother and younger siblings would move to California. March 27, 1963, about 5 months after Larry vanished, his remains would be found on a farm in Alexander, North Dakota. Chester and Larry's roommate from the hotel, Sam, was still living in North Dakota and would help investigators identify Larry's remains based on his clothing. Sam told investigators that he was sure it was Larry based on the jacket that Larry was wearing, saying that he remembers buying that jacket for Larry. An autopsy would reveal that Larry died of asphyxiation and he had been essayed. He had been strangled with a rope cord that had been found wrapped around his wrist. Based on the scene, investigators couldn't tell whether Larry had been killed there or somewhere else. Where they found Larry's remains, there were several beer cans, pop bottles, and what looked like either a towel or a piece of cloth from a car seat. Investigators did contact Chester out in California and let him know that they thought that they had found Larry's remains, and Chester did get on a flight right away and come out to North Dakota. When Chester arrived, he did positively identify the remains as his brother Larry, and him and Sam took a polygraph test and were eliminated as suspects. There were two suspects throughout the years that investigators did focus on. One, investigators say they were never able to question or interrogate, and another who ended up in an Alaska mental health institute about a year after Larry vanished. Case was originally with Williams County authorities, but by the October the following year after discovering Larry's remains, they were no longer pursuing the case and they turned it over to McKenzie County. Sheriff Lutz, who worked the case in 1963, believed that the person responsible in Larry's death was a transient, but he said he's still worried about children in the area being possible victims. Despite Larry's case remaining unsolved for 62 years, investigators say they are not giving up, and they are looking for any information in Larry's case. If you have any information, please contact the McKenzie County Sheriff's Department at 701-444-3654. Today, I will be spotlighting the case of Laura Jean Dugan. Laura Jean Dugan at 14 was already a kind soul and innately thoughtful of others. Bill Dugan, Laura Jean's stepfather, said, quote, "She was one of the most beautiful little things in the world. She was just like a little butterfly," unquote. Laura Jean's mother, Betty, had four children with her first husband, a cattle rancher, and Laura Jean was the third. The fourth sibling was a little girl that was born with one lung and unfortunately would die 9 months later. Betty and her cattle rancher ex-husband divorced in 1957, and she and the three children, Sherry, Victor, and Laura Jean, moved to Billings, Montana, in a small house where Betty worked as a waitress at the airport cafe. This is where Betty would meet Bill Dugan, who was a mechanic for Northwest Airlines. In 1962, Betty and Bill would marry and move their family from Milwaukee before settling in Minneapolis, Minnesota. In 1964, Bill and Betty would have a daughter named Ella, and in 1969, the family moved back to Montana for a brief time. They bought a house along the Yellowstone River, and Bill continued to work for the airline. Laura Jean was described as family as a bit of a tomboy who often spent her time creating mischief at every turn. Betty said about Laura Jean, quote, "She was very adventurous, extremely so, and never afraid of anything. She caught butterflies, she chased boys with snakes and creepy crawlers, she caught bees in her hands and turned them loose on people," unquote. Her stepfather Bill recalled a time that the groundskeeper from a local cemetery showed up with Laura Jean in tow. The groundskeeper informed Bill that Laura Jean had been taking flowers from other graves. Bill sternly asked her why she would do such a thing, to which she replied, quote, "There was a bunch of graves that didn't have any, and these others had so many, I thought that they could share them," unquote. That was just the type of girl that Laura Jean was. After 9 years of marriage, Bill and Betty separated in 1971. At this time, the oldest son, Victor, joined the army stationed in Germany, now leaving 16-year-old Sherry to care for her sisters while her mother, Betty, worked late nights tending bar. Sherry recalls that this was a very chaotic time in their household and that there were lots of men trying to get Betty's attention. Many men were working to date Betty, and Sherry said that Laura Jean was confrontational at this age and began to assert herself and express her issues with the men that Betty was dating. On the morning of April 7th, 1972, Laura Jean and her mother Betty would get into an argument about one of the men Betty was dating. Sherry says that Laura Jean liked this man that Betty was dating and wanted her mother to marry him, but her mother said she would never marry that man. Laura Jean, frustrated with her mother, grabbed her younger sister and headed to the street corner a few blocks away to catch their school bus that morning. Sherry says she remembers watching her sisters from the window as they walked away from the house before leaving to catch her own bus to school that morning. This was the last time she would ever see Laura Jean. However, Laura Jean's mother, Betty, has a completely different account of that morning. She said that Laura Jean had asked to stay home from school because she was feeling sick and Betty didn't believe she was sick, so she told her she had to go to school anyway. She said the other girls had already left for school at that time, and Laura Jean had argued with her before she left about having to go to school. According to her classmates, Laura Jean did ride the bus to school, but she didn't go to class. Betty said she was told, quote, "Apparently she handed her books to one of her friends and took off down the freeway," unquote. When Laura Jean didn't arrive home after school, her mother Betty wasn't too alarmed at first, because Laura Jean had run away shortly before Christmas. That time, Laura Jean had hitchhiked, and she was picked up by the sheriff, and her mother was forced to go pick her up. At the time, there was a horrible snowstorm happening, and when Betty picked up Laura Jean, she asked her what she was trying to do, and Laura Jean told her she was trying to go back to Minneapolis. So this is what Betty thought was going on. She figured that Laura Jean would call her when she was ready to get a ride home, and that she probably went out to see friends from Lame Deer or family and friends close that they frequently visited around Minneapolis. Unfortunately, though, 2 days later, Laura Jean's remains would be found in Medora, North Dakota, 250 miles away from her home in Huntley, a short distance from Interstate 94. A rancher checking on his cattle ranch came across Laura Jean's remains. Based on the scene, investigators believe that the killer had stopped at the area, which was a scenic overlook of the North Dakota Badlands, and Laura Jean attempted to escape by running towards some of the buildings in the distance and was caught in the barbed wire fence. Laura Jean's remains would be found under a cedar tree off of a worn cattle path. Laura Jean always wore a cross around her neck that was now dangling in a tree, and her clothes were awkwardly on her body, and she had been strangled and stabbed. Betty says she remembers that Sunday morning, the day before they found Laura Jean. There was a sudden moment where she knew she was dead. Betty said, quote, "I knew exactly. I heard it. I heard the screams. I knew exactly. And then there was peace. She wasn't suffering anymore. She did suffer terribly for those 2.5 days. Unquote. Sherry remembers being called out of biology class by the principal that Monday morning over the school intercom. Before she could reach the principal's office, standing in the hall was her mother with a sheriff deputy. In her gut, she knew that Laura Jean was dead. She said she directed her anger right at her mother for years and is still very angry. She said, quote, "It's hard to forgive. It's very hard," unquote. Despite their divorce, Bill would accompany Betty to Bismarck to identify Laura Jean's remains and help her make arrangements to return her body to Montana. Bill made sure that Laura Jean's dental records were also sent to North Dakota as another form of identification for her remains. Betty said that they were told that Laura Jean received numerous superficial cuts and that she had died of strangulation. Investigators promised Betty that her daughter's killer would be caught. Laura Jean's memorial had so many people that there was only standing room. Their family received so many donations that they used it to build a basketball court in Huntley Park, and the family hopes to place a memorial for Laura Jean near the court. For weeks after Laura Jean's funeral, Sherry would ride Laura Jean's bike the 2 miles to the cemetery, sometimes twice a day, to visit her sister. She said she spent a lot of time crying at Laura Jean's grave and screaming into the hills. A few months later, Bill would return to North Dakota, where they found Laura Jean's body, because he had to see it for himself. He checked in with investigators and he met with Ted Cornell, the sheriff of Billings County, North Dakota, and together they went out to the spot where Laura Jean was found. The sheriff apologized to Bill and said they just didn't have money or resources to commit more effort to investigating this case. Betty states that she spent several years after her daughter's death trying to find the killer herself, and said after losing another child, it was just an unbearable grief that she didn't want to live anymore. She just wanted to die. Investigators say they just don't have any solid suspects in Betty's case. Betty said when she questioned investigators about her daughter's killer, she was told there wasn't enough money or influence in the family to continue to push this through. She said that didn't make any sense. Murder is murder, and law enforcement, they are supposed to solve that no matter what. Betty said she was skeptical of new efforts to solve her daughter's crime, saying, quote, "I don't think there'd ever be a solution to it, and there may not be anyway, and this may just be some more heartache to have to go through. The loss is still there, and it will be there till the day I die," unquote. Bill is also struggling with the revitalization of the investigation, saying that it seems like there's little benefit to opening painful wounds in her death. He said, quote, "It was just a shock that they'd bring it back up again. It's something I've been trying to forget for years. I've more or less buried it," unquote. Laura Jean's sister Sherry has said that she hopes that they will finally put a name to the killer that has haunted their dreams and stole their sister. Sherry also went on to say, quote, "All of our lives, all the stories we've been told about Laura Jean's death were reminders that there is a pure demonic thing out there. I have been sleeping with the lights on ever since," unquote. Both of Laura Jean's sisters have gone on to choose careers that help children and help them before they run away. Sherry says if they knew who killed Laura Lee, it would end years of suspicion and give resolution to the tragedy that their family has suffered. She said, quote, "It's about justice. She needs her justice," unquote. And we can help her family do that by continuing to share her face and her case again and again. If you have information in Laura Jean Dugan's case, please call the Billing County Sheriff's Department at 701-623-4323. Hi guys, welcome back to the 50 State Cold Case Spotlight, and today we are in North Dakota for day number 3, and today I will be spotlighting the case of Joseph Anderson. Joseph Anderson was born October 17, 1921 in Jamestown, North Dakota, and grew up in Cleveland, North Dakota. He served in the U.S. Army during World War II, and after his military service, he returned home to North Dakota, where he began a farm near Woodworth, which would become one of the largest farms in the area. Shortly after Joseph began farming, he met and married his wife, Hazel, in Jamestown. In 1966, Joseph started a manufacturing business in Minot, North Dakota. He invented a hay grinder to better feed his sheep. He patented the machine and began a manufacturing operation. This machine was called the Haybuster, and in 1969, he moved his business to Jamestown. At the time of his death, he employed over 100 people. His manufacturing company is now owned by his son, Jay. Joseph's friend, Jack Anderson, not related, has known him for 25 years and said in a September 1991 Sun article, quote, "He was a unique person, and actually he started with nothing and was given nothing, and he just had the drive to make things work," unquote. Roger, who was a neighbor to Joseph, said he was quite the businessman and always followed through on his words. And some still speak very highly of him. On September 16, 1991, at 1:35 p.m., police would get a call about a car that appeared to have blood stains and a foul odor parked in the Gladstone parking lot. When officers arrived around 3:30 p.m. that afternoon, they opened the trunk of the vehicle and they found Joseph, 69, deceased, dressed in only his underwear and wrapped in a green sheet. Joseph had last been seen at the Ducks Unlimited banquet on Thursday, September 12th. His car had been reportedly seen at the Gladstone Inn parking lot on Saturday, September 14th. Very little information has been released in Joseph's case, and on September 18th, 1991, the Stutsman County State Attorney, Wendy Salewski, told press that an X-ray of Joseph's body revealed no bullet or knife wounds. Also noted that the degree of digestion of the food in Joseph's stomach indicated that his death occurred within hours of eating the Ducks Unlimited Banquet. The green sheet that Joseph's remains were found in, investigators were able to trace that back to his home. However, investigators noted that there had been no immediate sign that someone else had been in the house that night. In November, Joseph's family would hire a private investigator to help look into his case. And on January 24th, 1992, the Sun newspaper would report that the private investigator was focusing their efforts on out-of-state business rivals as possible suspects in Joseph's case. This private investigator told reporters that Joseph had been looking for opportunities outside of North Dakota, and he believed that that could have gotten him in trouble. This private investigator also told reporters that he believes that the people that they were looking for weren't very nice, that they didn't believe in fair competition, and that they also had a few additional suspects that they were looking into. After a few months, this private investigator was not able to bring the family any answers and headed back to Nebraska. Local law enforcement, along with the Cold Case Investigation Unit, has continued to investigate Joseph's case, and they remain secretive about their efforts since the case is still active, which has led officials to decline the release of any information regarding the investigation in recent requests. The murder of Joseph Anderson has been unsolved for 34 years. If you have any information in Joseph Anderson's case, you are urged to contact the North Dakota Attorney General Cold Case Unit at 1-800-472-2185 or contact the Jamestown Police Department directly. I will be spotlighting the case of Sandra and John Jacobson. Sandra, 36, and her youngest son, John, 5, both lived in Bismarck, North Dakota, and were last seen November 16, 1996. Sandra had plans to take John over to her mother's house on University Drive area in Bismarck for dinner. On the way to her mother's house, Sandra had called the Bismarck Police Department from her cell phone. She was very upset, and she told officers that she believed a ritual satanic abuse was happening on a farm near Center, North Dakota, and that she was calling the Bismarck police over the Center Town police in Oliver County because she didn't trust that police department. A transcript included in that original police report describes this call from Sandra, stating that she was very distraught and she believed that a loved one was in danger of being essayed at the hands of a demonic cult. Bismarck Police Department told her that since it was outside of their jurisdiction, there was nothing that they could do. Sandra's mother said that when Sandra arrived with John that evening around 7:30 p.m., it seemed like Sandra was having a mental health crisis, and Sandra did agree to let her mother take her to the hospital for help. Sandra agreed to go, but she told her mother that she wanted to get gas first. So Sandra took John and they got into their 1990 gray Honda Civic. And it turns out that they did stop at a gas station and purchase gas. However, Sandra never returned home to her mother's house. Around 10 p.m. is when Sandra's mom decides to call and report Sandra and John missing. The next day, Sandra's vehicle would be found abandoned in Centennial Beach parking lot near the Missouri River in Bismarck. Officers were not able to locate Sandra or John in the area. The driver's side door of the car was open, and her keys were in the ignition. Sandra's purse was sitting on the front seat, and it looked as if nothing in the purse had been disturbed. That day, there were strong river currents and severe weather that delayed their efforts because it was not safe for investigators to go into the river as thoroughly as they would have liked to at the beginning of the investigation due to that storm. Before Sandra's disappearance, she had separated from her second husband, Alan Jacobson, John's father, just about 3 months prior. During that separation, Sandra would move into a trailer with John and her older son, Spencer, 16 years old from her previous marriage. Sandra and her family did believe that she was getting divorced and that that was all being handled by her ex, Alan, and Sandra was concerned about some upcoming custody battles. When investigators spoke to her ex, Alan, he never mentioned that they were getting a divorce, and they would later find out through their investigation that there was never a divorce pending. Alan had never started the process. Alan also told investigators that that November 16th day, he was on a business trip when Sandra and John disappeared in Missouri and didn't return until the 18th. However, investigators were never able to confirm that alibi. Beyond those few initial interviews in the beginning, Alan has not been cooperative with investigators. He refused to submit DNA and said that him and Sandra were actually reconciling and that they had signed up for couples therapy. However, the record shows that he never attended any of those appointments. After Sandra and John's disappearance, Sandra's family pled with investigators to please secure Sandra's trailer. But investigators didn't do that, and that allowed Alan to go into Sandra's trailer and remove items to include clothing and food. Because they didn't secure this trailer right away, investigators didn't get a chance to go in and look at Sandra's trailer before Alan cleared it out. Sandra's family said that Sandra kept a daily journal, and investigators asked Alan about this. He said he never found it in the home, and investigators have never been able to locate it. Spencer, Sandra's older son, said he saw his mother's wedding rings in a container at Alan's home a few days after his mother went missing, and he didn't understand why Alan had the rings and couldn't remember if his mother was wearing them the day she disappeared. Shortly after Sandra's disappearance, Alan would take over the trailer altogether and sell it. Since there was no legal divorce, he was able to claim all of her property. When Alan was questioned by investigators about these rings, he said that he believed that Sandra had left them when they first got separated. Investigators went on to ask him if he could take a polygraph test, and initially he agreed until they received a call from his lawyer a few days later saying that he would not be taking the test. Sandra's family members say they know that she was experiencing a mental health crisis the day that she disappeared, but they do not believe that she would take her own life or her son John's. They said she was an incredible mother who loved her children deeply. She was never even known to raise her voice around her children or her loved ones, and no one could fathom her causing harm to her children. In May of 1997, 6 months after Sandra and John disappear, investigators find a shoe near the river, and they ask Alan, "Does this look like John's shoe?" And he says it could be, but he's not sure. They then ask Sandra's mother and Sandra's son, Spencer, who both say that that's not his shoe and it's probably too large for John's feet. Later in the investigation, investigators discovered that the day that Sandra had gone missing, she had earlier attempted to call her ex-husband Vernon Nestrom, Spencer's father, but was unable to reach him. When he was interviewed by investigators, he told investigators that during his marriage to Sandra, that she was fascinated and obsessed with the idea of the world ending and made a pact that if it looked like the world was going to end, they would meet and jump off the Memorial Bridge together. The Memorial Bridge is located close to where Sandra's vehicle was found after she went missing. Vernon did note that later on, though, Sandra did tell him that she thought suicide wasn't a good idea and it would condemn the victim's soul to walk the earth forever and they would never get a chance to enter heaven. He did agree to take a polygraph, and investigators say that they were able to rule him out as a suspect. In an unexpected and tragic twist, Vernon himself would be killed by a car in 2005 and left to die in a ditch on a maintenance road in Turtle, North Dakota. Investigators have ruled his case a homicide. The autopsy showed that he died of blunt force and trauma, and his case remains unsolved. However, they do not believe that it is connected to Sandra and John's disappearance. There are many theories that surround John and Sandra's disappearance. Some say that Sandra killed herself and took John with her. Others say that her ex-husband might have something to do with both of their disappearance. Shortly after their disappearance, Sandra's family did both have Sandra and John declare, but that didn't stop investigators from continuing to look for evidence in this case. Investigators state at this point there is no evidence pointing to foul play in their case, and they've never had a suspect. Investigators do believe that Sandra's journal could bring them answers in her case. Please keep sharing Sandra and John's story in hopes that we can bring investigators new leads. Any information in Sandra and John's case, you are asked to call the Bismarck Police Department at 701-223-1212. Today we are in North Dakota for our last day, day 5, and I will be spotlighting the case of Russell Turcotte. In 2002, 19-year-old Russell from Harve, Montana, who friends and family called a hippie at heart, took a road trip to attend the Rainbow Gathering in Michigan. Russell called his mother from a mini-mart in Grand Forks on the 13th of July, 2002, and told her that he needed $75 to get on a train to get home. Russell's mother, Linda, went ahead and wired Russell $100, but Russell never showed up the next morning to claim it. Russell was known to be a free spirit and a wanderer at heart, but he wouldn't go without contacting his family, so they knew when he didn't show up that morning, something was up. Russell's 24-year-old brother, Buck of Wolf Point, said, quote, "He's a happy-go-lucky kid. He stays in contact all the time. He's a good family person. I don't think he ran away from family," unquote. Russell's family immediately contacts the Grand Forks police, and Linda said at first when she told the dispatcher what was happening, the dispatcher chuckled and told her to wait a few more days. They then told her to file a missing report with her local agency in Wolf Point. She said she was told by Grand Forks police that they don't have primary jurisdiction in the beginning. After the weekend passed and Russell's family hadn't heard from him, they decided they were going to Grand Forks to look for him. They would stop at every roadside spot on the side of the road that looked interesting, every truck stop, and every town from Grand Forks to Wolf Point. His family also stopped at every police station they saw on the way there and asked about Russell. Buck and his father, William, plastered dozens of missing person signs at gas stations and handed out flyers in Minot, North Dakota at the state fair. Linda was able to trace down the mini mart that Russell originally called her from based on the phone number, and when she spoke to the employees there, they told her that Russell had been asking directions to a rescue mission. It would take months for Russell's father and mother to convince the Grand Forks police to get organized in helping search for their son. Russell's family would end up reaching out to Texas EchoSearch and pleading with the Grand Forks police to become involved. Nearly 3 months after Russell has disappeared, investigators finally work with Texas EchoSearch and more than 60 volunteers from North Dakota, Minnesota, and Montana covered 200 square miles in the search for Russell. The search teams were divided into 4 or 5 member teams, and they covered the north, south, and west areas of Grand Forks and both sides of the Red River. Investigators stated that it was more difficult for them to get involved in Russell's case at the beginning because they weren't certain that he was missing due to his vagabond lifestyle and he was known to hitchhike. Bill, Russell's father, said, quote, "They acted like this was a little hippie kid who wandered off, and we told them that isn't the case," unquote. Bill said from the beginning the police department would never take him seriously, and he believed that it was the fact that Russell was an American Indian and enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Tribe of the Chippewa, like his father and siblings, and that affected their urgency in searching for his son. On November 5th, 2002, Russell's remains were found about 12 miles northwest of Devil's Lake along the U.S. Highway 2. He was discovered in a row of trees, and his autopsy showed that he had been beaten to death. It would take investigators 3 years later to piece together a little bit more about the days leading up to Russell's disappearance. Earlier that July, they were able to confirm that Russell had been seen at the Rainbow Hippie Gathering in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. On his way home, he stopped at his friend's place in Brainerd, Minnesota, and spent the night July 12th in Fargo with new friends he had just met. The following day, he would hitchhike to Grand Forks and spend time at the Simonson truck stop on U.S. Highway 2. This is where he would call his mother, Linda, July 13th. She said he seemed okay and he just needed money wired so he could get home faster. Since Russell never picked up the money on July 14th like he was supposed to, investigators arrived that he disappeared sometime between overnight of July 13th and into the 14th. Russell's family also publicly stated that they did wonder at this point if their son's death and investigation are less of interest to law enforcement because they and Russell are Native Americans. Russell's mother, Linda, said, quote, "I'm going to always try to be optimistic about finding who killed him. We will do all that we can to make sure that happens, somewhere, in some fashion. We won't just give up. It's been a fight from the beginning because he was worth it. He was our son," unquote. It's now been 23 years, and there's been no suspects identified in Russell's case, and his case remains unsolved. His family has returned to Grand Forks throughout the years where his son was last seen in hopes of generating leads. You can help by continuing to share his face and his story. His family should have never had to beg law enforcement to get involved. No family ever should. Thank you for taking the time to get to know Russell today, and don't forget, every time you see a missing murder post on social media, hit like and share, because every time we share a face, we get closer to solving a case. Thank you for joining me for North Dakota for day number 5, and next week we will be going into Alabama. I'll see you then.